The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, and Chicago. And if you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Tim McKenna.
Hi, Diane.
Hi, Tim. Happy 4th of July weekend.
Happy tour weekend.
Oh, yeah, that little race going on. Yeah. Today was the first day this morning. I actually do not know what happened.
I don't either.
That's because I've been busy preparing for the show.
Yep.
And did you notice we have some new opening music?
I love the new intro music.
Do you? Greg calls it ear candy.
Or musical porn or...
Yeah, okay.
No, maybe not that. We don't. No, maybe not.
Well, we thought that after 200 shows, it was time for some audio redecorating. And listeners, let me know if you like it. I love it. I think it's really kind of cool. We also hope that everyone here in the States had a safe and fun 4th of July, that, you know, that your dog stayed home. You didn't lose your dog. Evidently, lots of pets get lost when they hear all the fireworks.
Yeah. And hopefully everybody still has 10 fingers and
oh, yeah. Why do we want to go there?
Leave that to experts.
Can I give a good shout out?
Yes.
Okay. Good shout out to our friends, the kids from the Bronx Lab School in New York City. They are on the road again in Ohio, with our friend Chuck Harmon from Columbus. They are riding, they are camping, and they are eating out in the great outdoors, cooking their own food, doing things they've never, ever done before because they live in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And they are riding bicycles, some of them for the very first time, long distances. And they're doing a portion of the Underground Railroad. So big shout out to you guys. Stay safe and have a lot of fun here in Ohio. We'll be thinking about you throughout the weekend. But let's get to our show, shall we? We have a lot to talk about this evening. In January 2013, we spoke with transportation planner and the president of the Florida Bike Association, Mike Wilson. At that time, Mike, along with Carrie Caffrey and a few other cycling advocates, were just putting the finishing touches on the Orlando, Florida I Am Traffic Colloquium. So in the more than year that's passed, there's been a lot of work that's gone on developing programs, ideas, and a new organizational structure finally has been formed. This week, Mike announced the results of all that work, and many believe it's going to be a big part of the answer to educating and implementing new programs for cyclists and drivers. Mike will fill us in on the brand new American Bicycle Education Association, why it was formed, what it is mandated to do, and what comes next to further programs such as Cycling Savvy and Understanding Bicycle Transportation Problems, which is sort of an engineering program. We will also be hearing from our friend Patrick Brady of Red Kite Prayer. He has a book review of the new George Hincapie book, The Loyal Lieutenant, Leading Out Lance and Pushing Through the Pain on the Rocky Road to Paris. I figured this was a good time to review this book since stage one of the tour began in England this morning. The book chronicles the now-retired cyclist's rise to greatness and, for the first time, his perspective on the use of performance-enhancing drugs. We'll hear Patrick's perspective on the book. My first guest, however, this evening is a real heroine. Jackie Crowell is a champion many times over. She began winning races while in college. She's an 8-time national champion. She was a champion as a junior 5 times. In the under-23 category once, and twice as an elite cyclist. She graduated from the University of Florida in 2011 with a degree in mechanical engineering. She's engaged to be married. She is a member of the very successful United Healthcare Women's Cycling Team. However, while racing in Colorado, she began experiencing strange symptoms, and it was discovered that she has a gliosarcoma, which is a subtype of a brain tumor called glioblastoma. Jackie's speech at this year's Breaking Away from Cancer dinner at the Amgen Tour of California was hopeful and heartbreaking. I wanted to learn more about this beautiful, courageous, and bright cycling star. So I am very pleased to welcome Jackie Crowell to the Outspoken Cyclist. Jackie, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I want to begin our conversation at the beginning with a six-month-old baby whose mother declared, "Look at those strong cycling legs." Is that true?
Yes, that is true. My parents are cyclists, not racers. They're just recreational cyclists. They actually met in a bike club in Orlando. And so, yeah, you could say that sentence is basically the... It's true. I mean, start at it. I came from a cycling family.
You know, it's sort of like a predetermined life in a way.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much that goes into cycling between the equipment and everything and just travel to races. And my parents already kind of had that in control by the time I was born. So, yeah, it started out quite a good situation.
Well, from what I could tell, you didn't immediately want to accept the fact that you're going to be born to ride.
No. I put up some resistance. My parents have always made school a priority, and really I liked being an all-rounder. I liked trying different things, and so, you know, I didn't want to just corner myself into a particular stereotype too early in my life, and so I tried a lot of different things. I was a rower, I was a swimmer, I studied a lot of different things. I just wanted to really see what I liked and figure out what I wanted to do with my life instead of having someone else tell me.
Evidently, they gave you the space to do that.
Yes, they did.
Yeah. You have siblings?
I do. I have a younger sister. We'd go on these family bike rides, and she would partake in those. And I think we both liked cycling equally, but then she ended up going the kind of music liberal arts route, and I stayed with it. I don't know. I think mainly because I was good at it.
That's always good. When you're good at something, you just kind of tend to pursue it. And then you like it, although in real life, you're a mechanical engineer.
I actually cannot claim that I'm a mechanical engineer because I haven't taken the professional test to claim I'm a mechanical engineer, but I have a degree. One of the other cyclists at my school, Bobby Sweeting, ended up working in the cycling industry for a while as an engineer. And so it was certainly a possibility. And then all of a sudden I got really fast and I wanted to devote all my time to cycling and just see where it took me, because all of a sudden I went from being a college student who was really good at cycling to someone who could actually say that they're training for the Olympics and have that be a possibility. So then all of a sudden Rio 2016 was on my lips, and, you know, I'd always been athletic, but, you know, having it be really there and really feasible, you know, it's a whole different feeling.
Well, and I want to talk a little bit about your sort of cycling career, some of your great cycling moments. I mean, you have 8 national championships. Take us through the steps. You really started riding in college. That's where you became more of a team player, so to speak.
Yeah, I started riding in, well, I rode my whole childhood, and I even went to junior nationals. That's where most of my national titles are from.
Oh, that's before you were in college. Okay.
Yeah, and I was just so fit from my swimming background, because I think you talk to any swimmer and they tell you about the hours and hours and hours you do of aerobic activity in the pool. So I was able to go just with my cycling background. I was able to use the fitness from swimming to then go win junior nationals several times. So I won junior nationals several times, and then I have one national championship in the U23 time trial, and then two elite national championships on the track, which is basically a fluke.
Well, yeah, where did you train for track?
Well, Atlanta has a velodrome, which is where I was tonight coaching juniors at the Dick Lane Velodrome in Atlanta.
Cool.
And so I trained here just for a little bit to get myself prepared. And I honestly went out there thinking it was going to be a fun trip. And then I show up and Mike Tamayo is there with Lauren Tamayo, like laying down the law. And I hadn't interacted with Mike very much, actually not at all. And, you know, a couple hours after being there, Mike starts texting me like, "You're late. Where are you? Training started 2 minutes ago." And that was one of my first interactions with Mike. And, you know, that was, I guess that was over a year later was when he contacted me to sign me for UHC. But, you know, he's one of those people that he can tell what kind of rider you are from. I think anyone can tell what kind of person you are from how you react to pressure. And he put the pressure on, and I was able to step it up a little bit, and we ended up winning the team pursuit. Sorry. See, that's how much of a roadie I am. I say team time trial. We won the team pursuit there that year. And then I won, and I had just come off doing the women's La Route de France with, we had the yellow jersey there for several days, but it was a big block of training. And so I just came into track nationals so fit that I just kind of blew everyone away.
Well, kind of blowing everyone away is a good thing. I'm speaking with Jackie Crowell. She is a champion cyclist. She is with the United Healthcare Women's Cycling Team. We have a lot to talk about. I want to talk a little bit about women in cycling because you probably have a good perspective. So one of my friends is Inga Thompson. And, of course, uh-huh. Inga goes back into the early days of women's cycling. When I say early, you know, in the modern era. And lots of things were happening in those days that discouraged her, and she quit cycling. And I want to know how women's cycling is doing right now and what you think needs to happen in women's cycling at this time in history.
Well, I'm sure you've seen in the press that a lot of people are talking about the direction women's cycling should take. And we've seen steps in the right direction with, you know, Half the Road documentary and the women's La Course this year. I believe there's been more press for the women's Giro this year. And especially after the Olympics and the fantastic Olympic road race, people really started to realize that women's cycling is real. It's not just it's not just some sort of show that's put on for the sake of saying that men and women have equal opportunities in cycling. Like, there's actually a depth to the field now that makes it feasible to have the kinds of sponsorship that the men have.
And do you think there'll be parity in terms of money?
You know, I don't have a business degree. So I'm not really sure what to say about that. I mean, like, the situation with the difference between men's and women's salaries is, you know, the women get paid in relation to what the media have put out there. And because you don't see the women in the media, you don't see them on TV, that makes sponsors less likely to sponsor the teams, and that's really what it comes down to. So if we could tackle it from the media standpoint first, that would be the quickest way to go about it, but it's just a matter of convincing the media to do so. So we'll see, we'll really see how the women's La Course goes, and hopefully, I mean, I know it'll be an impressive race. From my point of view, you know, I'm a little upset that it's just one stage.
Right.
But, you know, if that's all they can do now, then, you know, that's what we're going to do. And UHC is sending a team, and we're gonna give it our all and try and win, of course.
Well, and I think that we're going to start seeing, this is just my opinion, but in talking to a lot of other women, I think we're going to see a lot more effort being put into women's cycling, as you said, with the media and with organization, and perhaps sponsoring women's teams will be more lucrative for some of these companies with positive press as opposed to bad press. So, which
yeah,
is another whole.
I mean, I think that like anything, it's going to take time, but it's women's cycling. Like, I am so passionate about cycling and women's cycling. Like, I know that once the media grabs hold of it, it's going to blow everyone away. I mean, you saw the press and the press generated by the fact that my team donated the Volkswagen GTI to me after the Nationals road race. And it's stuff like that, you know, it's only because they ran the women's pro, they created this U.S. Pro along in conjunction with the men's U.S. Pro that my team was able to do that for me, and get the press to back it up. I mean, these types of things happen in women's teams, like the camaraderie, you know, the ups and downs. It's a very cool atmosphere, and it's just now that people are starting to realize it because of this press.
Which is good. It's a good thing.
Yes, very good.
I want to address the rest of what we're going to talk about, which is your future. We spoke in our opening of the speech you gave at the Amgen Tour of California this year, and I don't think anyone could have watched it and not have been brought to tears, including me. Tell us what happened and when you said you presented with your first symptoms. Take us back to that, and we're going to move forward a little bit with your medical issues.
Yeah. Well, really, my first symptoms occurred at Tulsa Tough last year. So at Tulsa Tough in 2013, those were my first symptoms.
And what were they?
And really, I was in my hotel room the night after the second race, and I was doing laundry in the sink, and all of a sudden, you know, because that's what I have to do, like, we don't have laundry.
Right.
Like, I was doing laundry in the sink and with my hands in the hot water, and I suddenly got this tingling down my arm, and I was like, oh, my arm's going numb. And then it just kept spreading over the right side of my body. And then it went away. And of course, it freaked me out, and I went and got someone else just to tell them what was going on, and then it went away. So I didn't really think anything of it because it wasn't painful, and it didn't affect my racing. I ended up making a lot of money that weekend and getting second overall and really figuring out how to sprint for the first time. So it was a very good weekend for me overall. But then I just kept having these tingling feelings that would last about 5 minutes and then just go away. I would have them in races. I remember particularly the Cascade Crit that year. I have little tingling sensation that happened halfway through, and I was like, oh, should I stop? And then it just went away. And then later on, I found out that those were actually seizures. I was having seizures during races.
Oh, no.
And yeah, I mean, that's kind of when I talk about the hardcore nature of women's cycling, like, you know, that's the point I was at. I was like, so I was working so hard for my team that I was willing to have a seizure in a race and keep going, and just for my teammates. Like, I wasn't at Cascade for the GC. Like, I was at Cascade to help my team.
And you were not actually experiencing symptoms that took you off the bike. This was happening while you were riding. Holy smokes. Jackie!
And so, I mean, I really, like, you know, I wanted to finish out the season and then try and figure out what it was. But of course, you know, they wanted me on the team pursuit team for Rio, or at least, you know, to attempt to get on the Rio team pursuit team. And so I went straight from road to track again, and I just never really had time to figure out what was going on. And then all of a sudden I was at Colorado Springs Olympic Training Center, and I get out of the shower, or I start twitching in the shower. So I had the first motor control symptoms. I was twitching in the shower, and I just grabbed my towel and ran out, and Carrie Higgins was right there. And she immediately was like, you know, freaked out and got a doctor. And it only lasted 5 minutes. They sent me home, and I think everyone who was there, so like Sarah Hammer was there. I mean, it was like the final cut for Rio, they'd cut a bunch of girls, and so it was like, 12 of us left to qualify for 4 spots. And, I had just done stellar times, and so I was like really on a high because I just beaten Sarah. And I know Sarah was kind of out of shape then, but I just gotten the fastest time in one of our little tests, and I was on a high, and then getting sent home and then finding out that, I got a brain MRI, and there's a tumor in my brain. It's kind of unreal.
I am speaking with Jackie Crowell. We are talking about what happened to her in 2013 at just an incredibly pinnacle time in her cycling career. So who actually did the MRI? Where were you? Were you back in Atlanta?
So this is, So I was living in Atlanta just because my now fiance works. He's a manager for Team Novo Nordisk development team or development program. So that's all based in Atlanta. And so I was spending quite a lot of time in Atlanta. And so I went home, and this is just where it gets even weirder. The day that it happened was just such a crazy day because it was the same day that Amy was killed.
Dombrowski.
Yeah, and
yes.
Yeah, and she, it was just, I found out that she, on my way to the doctor to get my MRI results, I found out about her death, and then I get into the doctor's office and I have a brain tumor. And then I drive home from the doctor's office, and they, with brain tumors can vary in a lot of ways, but, they wanted to get me in for surgery as soon as possible, but they sent me home. And while I was driving home, my brain tumor hemorrhaged. Usually you have like days or months before they need to get it out, but my brain tumor needed to come out then. And so I don't know if it was just I was upset or it was just everything was just so overwhelming. The doctors say that it's just a coincidence, but my brain tumor hemorrhaged and I was paralyzed on the right side of my body for 3 days until they took it out.
And I mean, when I saw your speech, you looked well. You looked wonderful.
Yeah. That's one of the things that's, I think, most difficult for people to grasp is because it took me a while to get to this point. For a while, I couldn't walk. I had to learn how to walk again. I had to learn how to ride again. I had to learn how to dress myself again. And because I'm right-handed and my right arm was just completely useless for a while. So I have that unique experience of being paralyzed the technical term probably isn't paralyzed, but being unable to move a part of my body and then not coming back. So that's so strange. It's hard to describe. So I look good. I mean, I feel great. I'm still going through chemo treatments I'll go through treatments for a year and then they'll take me off that and then kind of see what happens. But people don't realize that while I was giving that speech, I was on chemo. And I was exhausted afterwards, of course, but some things are worth sacrificing for.
Sure.
And I just want to spread the word about brain cancer and cancer in general. And since I've been diagnosed, I've done a lot of reading, a lot more reading. I found out a lot more information on cancer in general, and it's been a motivator for me because this thing needs to be cured. It's about time we cure it, and I want to be part of the solution.
Do you think that prognosis today is better than it's been, say, 5 years ago, 10 years ago? Have there been advancements that are helping you now that wouldn't have been available if this had happened 10 years ago?
Yeah, there's been this particular drug, temozolomide, its molecules are small enough that they can get through the blood-brain barrier and actually attack brain tumors. So that's been the major innovation toward treating brain tumors in the last 10 years. But I believe that was actually 10 years ago. So there hasn't been much that's trickled down from clinical trials. Standard of care is just temozolomide and then see what happens. Nothing really else has come in other than that drug that they give to you straight away.
You are riding again?
Yeah, I am riding again. Since it's been warmer out and stuff, I've tried to train, I think, a little too early and just got, I mean, I think every cyclist can relate to training as a job, and I had just done it for so long as a job that I needed a little more than just a few months off.
Right, right. You're coaching some juniors?
Yeah, I've always been a coach because, you know, I said I'm passionate about cycling. And right now, because I'm not traveling, I coach juniors at the track here on Mondays and Thursdays. I think I do it more for me than them because it's absolutely adorable, and they're such hard workers. I love to see, like, and they improve just immediately, like just after a few workouts, and you can really see the rewards and the work they put into it. And they're just adorable. I really enjoy doing that.
How old are they?
The youngest, they're 8 years old.
Oh, they're
kids. And they go all the way up to 18.
Oh, that's adorable.
So we have,
right.
Yeah, we have a younger group and then an older group. And, you know, the older group, I mean, they race like grown-ups. Even though they're, some of them, I'm holding them for standing starts, and I'm like, how much do you weigh? And the kid's like, 60 pounds.
That's
yeah,
cute.
I'm like, wow, I haven't weighed that much since I don't even know when.
Right, exactly. I can't count back that far. So are you planning a wedding?
We've now been, I mean, Daniel and I have been together for just 3 years.
Okay.
Actually, almost exactly 3 years. So nothing's changing there. I know people keep asking about the wedding. And
yeah, forget
like
it.
Like you said, especially since I look so healthy, people will always come ask. Actually, just even today, it came up to me and said, oh, I hear you're a cancer survivor. And I'm like, well, not yet.
Yeah.
I don't quite know what to say because
I
do look so good that people are under the impression that, you know, this isn't a very serious disease. I think I can, and I also, you know, I smile a lot, and people can be tricked into thinking that I'm not as under as much stress as I am, but it's really, you know, having my teammates do things like donate me the car, you know, now I get to race around town in my VW, and having Mara do things. Mara has made some charms for the Giro to give to all the girls. She said that working for me at Nationals was so motivational and so successful that she wants to try it again at the Giro. And I was just doing things like knowing that I'm not forgotten. I mean, you can fall out of the sport of cycling so quickly, and just knowing that my team is still thinking of me is such a blessing. It's such a positive thing to have that, you know, oh my gosh, I love my team, and I'm so heartbroken that I can't be at the Giro with them.
Well, you are there in spirit, and they know that. And I am just thrilled to have been able to talk with you about all of this tonight. I wish you all the luck in the world. I think you obviously have some good luck because you're getting great treatment. You have great people around you. You have the support of your team. And now you have the support of all of our listeners because they're all going to want to know how you're doing. And we will keep tabs on you.
Thank you so much for having me, Diane.
It is just absolutely my pleasure. Have a wonderful 4th of July weekend, and I know you're going to be watching the tour.
I will, yeah.
All right, and we'll talk again, yes?
Uh-huh,
okay.
For sure.
All right, bye-bye.
Thank you, bye.
Bye-bye. Jackie Crowell joined me from her home in Atlanta, Georgia. Well, we need to take a break. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We'll be back in a moment.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
I'm Diane Lees.
And I'm Tim McKenna.
And we are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. And before we head down to Orlando to talk with Mike Wilson about the new organization, which I'm very excited to talk about, we have some news.
Yes, we always have news.
Yes. What's your first news item?
The first news item, and this comes from metro.co.uk. This is about a cyclist. Bogdan Ionescu was hit with a ridiculous 20-pound charge because he only had one handbrake on the left side of his bike and no braking mechanism on the right. He was stopped by police while riding his bike in Cologne, Germany in March for an apparent violations of road safety laws. The theater box office worker received the penalty notice despite having legally modified his bike so he can control another brake with his foot. But Mr. Ionescu received an apology and had the fine rescinded this week after the story was picked up by local and national media. It's great news. I'm really happy, he told the newspaper. It's good that this is how it ends. It's unbelievably good. The important thing to know about this is Mr. Ionescu only has a left arm.
Of course.
I like that in Cologne, Germany, they're concerned about safe vehicles, but I think a little common sense would have saved a lot of time with
you
this.
You think? Well, we'll go from the ridiculous to the sublime. This comes from the Telegraph out of the UK. Why does cycling attract so many snobs?
I don't know of any, but...
This is by Jamie Fury, and he introduces sportive snobbery. A new breed of cyclists is infecting our roads and destroying the inclusive nature of bike riding. So it was inevitable that with the rapid growth in cycling, factions would emerge. Subgroups of cyclists who define themselves by how seriously they take their sport, their kit, their observance of cycling's heritage, gangs, and coteries who jostle to adopt the lifestyle to a greatest degree, reach a critical mass of humans who enjoy a shared interest, and lines will inevitably be drawn. The peloton rarely sticks together. For the most part, this is fine. As with any pastime, there will be those who are content with occasional participation and those who immediately look to emulate the pros. But there's a downside as well, snobbery. The idea that some are not only better than others, but that those at the lower end of the commitment and ability scale shouldn't really be there at all. I've noticed it a few times in discussions about the professional side of cycling, where commentators have a disdain for the popularization of their sport since Bradley Wiggins won the Tour in 2012. It says they hold Wiggins personally accountable for allowing the great unwashed in on the secret, or in forums and articles where self-defined guardians of recreational cycling denigrate those who have the gall to wear a yellow jersey, as if doing so aligns the amateur with Eddie Merckx. And then there's the articles about whether people should or shouldn't wear Lycra. I do, in case you're wondering. So it's really a cute article, and it kind of goes on and on and on. It was published June 30th in the Telegraph in the UK. I think it's clever.
Do you know what a Kirby is?
A Kirby.
C-U-R-B-E-E.
Okay. So, all right, I'll bite.
Okay. So on the ChicagoStreetBlog.org, and this is from the 27th of June, Street Blog Chicago writer Stephen Vance doesn't just report on the transportation news. Sometimes he makes it. Case in point is the city's newest cycling amenity, a bike footrest and handrail that Stephen and his friend Ryan Lakes recently installed on the southeast corner of Milwaukee and Ogden across the street from the Matchbox Bar. It's a very simple piece of street furniture, a place to put your foot, and a bar to grab onto while you're waiting for a red light.
If you're taking one foot out to put your foot there anyway, why not just step down on the curb?
I think it's probably not for, now we're being snobbery again, aren't
uh-oh,
we?
Uh-oh.
If you're clipped in, you're probably not going to come out at all. The idea is that at least you're going to keep one of your feet on the pedals and you'll be able to leave the intersection quicker. It also encourages stopping in that it's a little bit easier once you do stop and once you wait there. So
A Kirby, huh?
Kirby, C-U-R-B-E-E. Okay.
This is a victory story. It comes from Velo News. It's by Addie Levinsky. It's victory after tragedy for Kirsten Williams. And she's standing on a podium with two other lovely ladies. And this is at the track. Perseverance, determination, drive. Just a handful of the traits possessed by elite athletes necessary for success and even more essential for struggle. There are no better words to describe the 18-year-old track star Kirsten Williams. She won Omnium and individual pursuit titles at this year's USA Cycling Junior Track Nationals in Carson, California. An incredible feat for any young athlete. But Williams' success was more than a dream come true. Her national championship title was not won just for her, but for her late father. Victor Williams was the victim of a tragic accident at the 7-Eleven Velodrome in Colorado Springs just 2 weeks prior to the Junior Track Nationals. A seasoned track racer and president of the National Grocers Amateur Team, passion for track racing pulsed through his veins, and while he may be gone, this passion carries on with his daughter. Not only did Williams display an unbelievable amount of determination to win last weekend's Junior National Championships, she overcame a nearly incomprehensible tragedy. She was present at the track when her father's accident occurred. Instead of backing away with fear, Williams acknowledged the presence of her father on that very track and continued to race. Whenever I ride by the corner where he crashed, I feel like he is cheering me, so that is actually comforting, she said. I was a little nervous to ride on the track for the first time, but knowing he died doing what he loved also helped me to overcome any fear and just enjoy the track because that's what I love too. So it's kind of a tragic story with a sort of bittersweet ending. Got another one?
We'll finish up with this one. This is by Debbie Snook of The Plain Dealer.
Oh, right here in Cleveburg.
Yep. And this was from July 2nd. I like how she starts out. We weren't astronauts back from the moon or championship ball players or newly elected presidents. But when the June 27th critical mass rolled past the east side of Cleveland from Public Square to the city of Euclid, shouts of Happy Friday went off like local confetti from the streets to the sidewalks, sidewalks to the street. We were happy to be there, and the people we passed were happy we were there. What more good can a group bike ride do? Now, I happened to be in Bratnall at the time and saw everyone go by with the police escorts and everything, and it was really a cool thing to see that many people.
You saw it coming and going.
I saw it coming and going because as I was headed that direction, there were a lot of people that were driving past me to go to Public Square where the critical mass started.
Right.
And then I happened to be at a house where they all drove past as they were headed the other direction.
Do you have any idea of numbers?
Several hundreds.
That's great.
There was a lot, and this is an appropriate comment for this weekend with the fireworks. Just when you think it's done, here come another batch of them.
Right.
And it was really good to see that there were Cleveland police, there were Bratnall police, Euclid police that followed along. And in this article, she goes on to explain, other than just the critical mass, which is on the last Friday of each month, she has a list of 25 adventure rides in Northeast Ohio. So
nice.
If you're looking for a ride, here's a great place to find it. And Debbie always does a nice job with, with her
She's
article,
been with the Plain Dealer a long time.
Yep.
Well, on that note, we're going to head on down to Orlando and talk with Mike Wilson, who is the chairman of the board, the El Presidente of the brand new American Bicycling Education Association. Mike, thanks for joining me on the show. Welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Last time we spoke, it was January of 2013, and I Am Traffic was just in the beginning stages, and the colloquium was going to get underway, but a lot's happened since then, huh?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Tell us a little about the announcement that you sent to me this week. It got me very excited about what's going on.
Well, we announced the formation of the American Bicycling Education Association. We're a 501c3 not-for-profit, and we're dedicated to the education of bicyclists as drivers of vehicles, and also to educate other professionals, such as traffic engineers and law enforcement, on how to understand how bicyclists should be treated as drivers.
So this isn't another League of American Bicyclists or People for Bikes. This is not an advocacy organization where you're going to have members per se.
Correct.
Okay. So explain how the ABEA is set up and how it's going to operate.
Rather than have members, because we did talk about whether or not membership would be a component of it. And, you know, we had to kind of ask the question, what benefits do members get from us and what benefits do we get from members within the context of what we're trying to do? And so it didn't really seem that membership was an exceptionally important feature for us. So when you look at organizations that tend to do well with membership, they are ones that have better defined and direct benefits to their members. You know, ones that are, you know, ongoing benefits.
Sure.
You get a regular magazine, or you get benefits that are of real value, ongoing value. But anyway, so what we're going to be doing is focusing more on providing the programs that, you know, people would pay for classes, and that would be our revenue stream, as well as working with other organizations that support the benefits that come out of an educated cycling population.
So something like Cycling Savvy, for example.
Well, absolutely. Cycling Savvy is going to be our flagship program for the outset. It's a fast-growing program, and we're struggling to control it as it grows and make it keep it functioning effectively through our growth spurts.
So, in the long term, what are the goals of the association?
Well, in addition to the adult traffic cycling that we do with Cycling Savvy, as I alluded to a little bit ago, we want to educate traffic engineers and planners so they have a better understanding of what types of facilities are complementary to how we educate cyclists and which ones are not so complementary. How to do good design that's consistent with how people should bike. Same with law enforcement. They need to have an understanding of why bicyclists have to behave in certain ways to be defensive drivers on the road.
Boy, you got that right.
Yeah.
Especially law enforcement. There have been an awful lot of issues this year with cyclists and drivers.
Right.
Okay.
And that speaks to another thing that we'd like to do. We see that there's a need for protecting the rights of bicycle drivers. We would like to develop a legal defense fund.
Interesting.
To help out cyclists that we think are in particularly important cases that need to be defended.
Eli Damon up in Massachusetts would have been a good case for this then.
Right.
Right. Right. Okay. So that is what you're talking about, people who seem to have run-ins. And right now we have Cherokee Shill down in Kentucky who's having some issues. And I'm sure her legal defense is going to end up costing a lot of money.
Right.
Yeah. So we do need this to be separate and apart from other cycling organizations. What's your role going to be in it?
Well, as the president of the board, you know, my main job is just to keep the rest of the board members from all talking at the same time. But no, actually, that's really not a problem. We've got an awesome board of very talented people who get along great and are all, you know, committed to the same ideals and making it all happen. So everybody's rolling up their sleeves and getting things done. So aside from that, being the spokesman for the organization is kind of a common role for a board president for an organization like ours. So that, there's that aspect to it as well.
So there are certain people on the board, but they're not all necessarily in the same location. They're like all over the place?
Right. Yeah, we're all over the country. We've got Jen Bowers in Louisville, Kentucky. And she's our vice president and a real good systems thinker. Elliot Landrum from Dallas, Texas, who's our tech guru. Andy Klein from Springfield, Missouri, who's a college professor in political science and a really good PR guy to have on our team. Waco Moore, also from Dallas, a businessman with some really good ideas on how to move us in a business sense, as well as Karen Carrible from St. Louis, also a business person. Lisa Walker here in the Orlando area has both good public relations and business experience with the Realtors organization here in Florida. A fellow named Tony Philpin up in Connecticut has a lot of experience with similar types of organizations and programs, and so he's brought a lot of valuable ideas in that respect. And then lastly, but certainly not least, is Carrie Caffrey, who has done amazing work on the curriculum side of developing cycling savvy, as well as guiding the unsexy, unrewarding technical side and administrative side on the back end to make sure that it keeps moving and working for us as a program.
I'm speaking with Mike Wilson. He is talking to us about the brand new American Bicycle Education Association, and it's a very exciting new direction, I think, to get cyclists and drivers trained appropriately through law enforcement and through the Cycling Savvy course. And you have a couple of other programs that are also running at this time. One thing that I saw that I think is very exciting is that you have an anonymous benefactor who is willing to match some fundraising up to $40,000. How did that happen?
Well, we just had someone who was very enthusiastic about what we're doing, totally believes in what it is that we're doing, has already donated $10,000, and as you mentioned, will match up to another $40,000. So the question is, what are we going to do with that, right? So staffing, of course, is essential if you're going to have a sustainable organization. So that gets us started with staffing and keeping that Cycling Savvy program moving, because not only is Cycling Savvy educating people, it's also a revenue source for us. And in order to grow and do the things we need to do, if we have more people running through the Cycling Savvy course, then we get more revenue. And then obviously there are other ways that we can bring in revenue to get more things done, such as grants, et cetera. So you've got to have staffing in order to make those things happen.
Do you think that Cycling Savvy will become the teaching method even over and above? I know that the League of American Bicyclists trains a lot of people with their program. And their program is just different from Cycling Savvy. And Cycling Savvy seems to have some really positive ways of getting people to ride very confidently. I mean, I've seen it. I've seen all the graphics. Do you believe Cycling Savvy can grow into the program that everybody wants to use?
I think it can. When we were first talking about what sort of course we wanted to create, we thought about what sort of things can people learn elsewhere that they don't need to go to a class for, or they can go online, they can go to YouTube and watch a video on how to change a flat tire. But when it comes to learning how to ride in traffic, it's more than just an information thing. It's also a social phenomenon that you're really trying to change the beliefs of the potential cyclist there. And that requires more than just information. It's more of an art of persuasion. And when you bring people together into an actual classroom and bring them out into the field, there are things that can happen there that it's very difficult to replicate online, type where you don't have the back and forth of an instructor and fellow students. And not that we still want to do those sort of things. We'd love to have an online course, but to us, the most effective thing is the hands-on, person-to-person communication.
Oh, absolutely. Watching the groups and Carrie, I know, is not the only one teaching, but I think what she's doing is teaching other teachers right now.
Absolutely. That's Carrie's focus, is training instructors. We have another training coming up in September in Southern California, which will be huge, and having 10 new instructors in the Los Angeles area will be a great, great growth for us.
Let's talk a little bit. I know the website just got launched. Tell our listeners how they can, if they're interested, see what's going on with the ABEA. Are you using it as an acronym, saying ABEA?
uh, I've heard a few people say ABIA. It hasn't totally caught on with me yet, but it probably will. You know, I guess it will roll off the tongue easily, more easily.
Yeah, maybe. Anyway, tell us about the website. And they can also see Cycling Savvy stuff out there, too.
Sure. Of course, everything's all linked together. The ABEA or ABIA site is abea.bike. We're fortunate to be able to get that.
No kidding.
Yeah, it's .bike.
Wow, and you're the first organization I know of who got the .bike designation. That's cool.
Yeah.
Wow.
And, of course, we also have a Facebook presence for ABEA as well.
Well, and hopefully if people are interested, you know, that they like what they see, maybe they'll be part of the matching funds. That would be fun.
That would be most appreciated, yeah. If we're going to make it happen, there's got to be funds to help us out.
Well, I know that the website just launched this week, and I wanted to make sure that we were in on the front end of what's going on. I personally believe in what you're doing. I think it's important work, and I'm glad to see that this is what came out of the colloquium and came up with such a focused response. I think it's awesome.
Well, it took quite a bit of time, obviously, you know, since then for the formation board to figure out where it needed to go. And we had this really great framework of, you know, the six E's that I think you had Dan Gutierrez on talk about that. But, you know, we had to turn that into something that would be a sustainable organization. That was the real challenge that we saw for moving forward. And education, we saw, was really had to be the linchpin for that to move ahead. That said, we do still need to focus on equality. For cyclists when it comes to, particularly with the law. And we're looking for more of a ground-up approach on that. We're hoping that we can replicate what we did here in Orlando with the Commute Orlando site and Cycling Savvy. There's some great synergies happening with that, where when you train someone to be a good cyclist, they don't want to go back to the way they used to ride, and they become very protective of their rights, and they want to make sure that they've got a community that supports their right to drive their vehicle defensively and effectively.
Well, I certainly appreciate you taking time to talk with me. I know you must be like crazy busy launching this just a few days ago. Once again, it is abea.bike.
Right.
That's so cool. And Mike Wilson, who is the president of the board of directors, thanks so much for talking with me. And I look forward to seeing all the great things you're going to do this year.
Thank you very much, Diane.
All right. You have a great night.
You too.
Okay. Bye-bye. Mike Wilson, who is the head of the new American Bicycle Education Association, joined me from his home in Orlando, Florida. What do you think?
I think yes.
You think yes. I agree. I think yes, too. I'm very excited to see that Cycling Savvy has a really secure home right now. So we're going to let Patrick Brady tell us about the new George Hincapie book, The Loyal Lieutenant.
I've been following his tweets, and when it says, "I've never been angrier when reading a book," I'm really interested to see what his review is going to say.
Let's head on out to California, and this is Patrick Brady giving us his review of The Loyal Lieutenant by George Hincapie.
More than any other writer, George Hincapie sat at the center of the storm of the EPO generation. Hincapie's pro career began before EPO was in widespread use, and as Lance Armstrong's loyal lieutenant, he experienced the same transition Armstrong did, made the same choice to use EPO, partly because of his closeness to Armstrong, and partly because of the incredible length of his career in cycling. No one else has ridden 17 Tours de France. His story is a chance to view cycling from a previous era through the years dominated by EPO and transfusions and into the present era. A narrative from his seat held the promise of a tour of the sport's underbelly. Alas, Loyal Lieutenant doesn't do that. As a result, it is the most frustrating book on the Armstrong era in print. The book's biggest problem is Hincapie's own deafness to his position in the cycling world. Most of the first half of the book is a loving look back at his career at Armstrong's side. No one is yet pining for a nostalgic look back at those days. this isn't the year to observe Armstrong's return from retirement as reunited with the man who helped create much of his magic, Johann Brunel. There are numerous lengthy quotes with former teammates, directors, and family members. At first, the praise is so effusive that the quotes read like he's being eulogized, but the tone with which I read them changed as the book progressed. There are some serious lapses in the book. On two occasions, he notes seeing athletes dope, teammates dope, but he doesn't name them. On another, he tells of a young teammate who almost goes down the path of doping, and Hincapie claims to have steered him away from that path. That he doesn't name names is a vote for omerta. It would be easier to take him not naming names if he didn't describe Tyler Hamilton's doping as doing some dodgy shit. He doesn't miss an opportunity to illustrate Floyd Landis in the worst possible light and even calls him the devil outright. So when he claims that Frankie Andreu got him into doping, a point Andreu denies, the reader can't help but wonder if certain passages of the book weren't redlined for editing by Armstrong and Bill Stapleton. The bigger problem is that where truthiness is concerned, game, set, and match have gone to Frankie and Betsy Andreu. The balance of the narrative has shifted in their favor. So anything at odds with what they say reads, to most cycling fans, as false. Later, in recounting how Chris Horner chased him down at the entrance to the Champs-Élysées on his final stage of his final tour, he says he asked Horner what he would have said to the authorities, to which Hincapie says Horner replied that he was lucky he didn't have to testify, which shows Hincapie isn't against implicating a rider in doping. It's this uneven treatment of the riders around him that undercuts his judgment as a narrator. In discussing his efforts to clean up cycling, Hincapie comes across as truthful and sincere, but the Hincapie behind the scenes is at odds with the Hincapie we saw publicly. He writes of wanting to tell the world how much cleaner cycling was in 2010, of how much he was doing to show young riders another path. It was during the same period of time that he issued the press release in which he said, "It's unfortunate that's all people want to talk about. I'm not going to partake in any cycling bashing. I have done everything to be the best I can be. I want to focus on the future of the sport, what it's done to clean itself up. I believe in cycling and I want to support it." Ultimately, Hincapie's greatest miscalculation is the public's perception that the sport was riddled with doping. He could have single-handedly convinced every cyclist on the planet to stop doping, but because the public didn't have any knowledge of those efforts, they would mean little. Part of the job of cleaning up cycling is communicating to the public what's being done. Fundamentally, it's an issue of transparency, and withholding names works against that. The closing of the book is perhaps Hincapie's best moment. In a meeting with Travis Tigard, he relates that Tigard's parting shot was what Hincapie would say to his daughter about his doping. Unable to form an answer at the time, the closing is his response, and one can feel the weight of a parent's responsibility and love in his answer.
Well, I want to say thank you to Mike Wilson, Patrick Brady, and Jackie Crowell for a wonderful hour of interesting conversation this evening. Enjoy the Tour de France, everybody. You know, stage two tomorrow. Have a lovely weekend. Oh, by the way, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.